At Just the News, we break the stories others in the media ignore or are too afraid to tell. We did it on Russia collusion, Hunter Biden, and the security and intelligence failures that preceded January 6th. Our stories have real impact and reach because we stick to the facts. I'm John Solomon. You can help me expand our honest, unvarnished, and unbiased reporting by becoming a premium member at Just the News. You'll get an ad-free experience and exclusive member-only access to events, and you'll be helping us dig up more truth. Join today at justthenews.com/subscribe.
Hello, ladies. Hello, gentlemen. This is the Victor Davis Hanson Show. Victor Davis Hanson is the star and the namesake, and he is the Martin and Ely Anderson Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution and the Wayne and Marsha Buskey Distinguished Fellow in History at Hillsdale College. Victor's official home on the internet is victorhanson.com. You should be subscribing to that, and I will tell you why. So later in the podcast, I'm Jack Fowler. I am the man lucky enough to be able twice a week to ask Victor questions that I think you would like to ask him. And Sammy Wink, the other, she's the great co-host. I'm just a co-host. She's a great co-host. Also has the same duties. Victor's been interviewing some people too. Hey, Victor, a lot to talk about today, as there is always. And the first has to do with your kind of home or nearby, Stanford University, and it had a free speech conference, what it seemed to have had to have been protected from a mob. And we'll get to that. And an important document going around that's about academic freedom. We'll talk, get your views on these things and other matters right after these important messages.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
We're back with the Victor Davis Hanson Show. So, Victor, I want to recommend to our listeners to visit the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal. And there's a Richard Vedder, V-E-D-D-E-R, Richard Vedder, has a piece about this academic a free speech conference that was hosted at Stanford. Victor, you would think a free speech conference would be a kind of thing that would be open to the public or have press or media there. But this conference had to be invitation only, and it needed protection from a mob. Of course, now, if you're in favor of free speech, you must be up to something nefarious. I mean, personally, I was at this now infamous conference on free speech a few years ago at Yale that was attacked by Yale students. We had a mob outside. Somebody, Greg Lukianoff of Fire, made a joke at the conference, and all of a sudden this mob showed up. Anyway, this is the new reality of not too far from where the free speech movement was created, Victor. And now we have to be wary of free speech. So there's that. And give your thoughts about what happened there, or just the thought that there would need to be protection for such a thing.
But what was strange about this is that Stanford has a history of not welcoming diverse views, that when people like Ben Shapiro come, they get a noisy, boisterous, hostile reception, and they blanket the campus with posters suggesting that he's a bug and he deserves a raid-like reception. So when this group decided, you know, to have a academic free speech conference at Stanford, they wanted invitation only, and they had a wide variety of different views. I mean, they even asked their former head of, as I remember, it was Ms. Strossen was the head of the ACLU at one point, and she's not conservative. And there were differences among the speakers. But then the Stanford community came back and said, well, this is closed to the public. Well, then they live streamed it so people could see what was going on in transparent fashion. But they didn't have very many resources. They weren't the university. They were an ad hoc group that didn't, you know, that wasn't like they were going to get a hall of 1,000 people and be able to hire security, which you would need to do at Stanford. And so it was kind of very strange. It was Orwellian that the community basically said, well, we protest groups like yours, but you didn't invite us inside the hall, so we couldn't protest and disrupt it. Basically, that was the message that I got from it. And I knew a lot of the people I was out of state during that period, so I didn't participate. But, I mean, they had some pretty diverse points of view. They had everything on climate change. Bhattacharya, you know, he talked about medical policy as it pertains to COVID. They had Tyler Cohen, an economist, Amy Wax, a controversial law professor. Yes, it was weighted more to the conservative side because the university is 93. I think the latest statistics that I saw at Stanford University, to take one example, were 93-94% of the campus community, its precinct voted left wing, or at least they gave money to left wing groups. I'm not sure which rubric is the precise percentage, but the point is it was overwhelmingly left wing, as is the campus. So this group said, we're going to have different views. They're going to be center right, but they're just a small voice compared to your megaphone. And yet you want to come in in an open forum, and we know what you do because we've seen what you do, and we're not going to allow you to disrupt it, and we're going to put it on the air. And that's what was so ironic about it.
Right. The same professors who would have, who did go after you, Scott Atlas, Niall Ferguson, it was about 2 years ago.
They went after Neil. They went right after him and called him a racist. They still call him a racist, married to a Somali, Ayan Hirsi Ali, who's black. They went after, we've talked about that at length, Scott Atlas. They went after me for suggesting that maybe the voting laws that were changed in March and April of 2020 were weighted to help Joe Biden, which they did. But that's not even controversial because the left, as we keep mentioning in the Molly Ball time, admitted such and bragged upon it. Didn't matter. They felt that they were going to settle up. And the point was that they were going to pick on people and haul them before the faculty senate and try to intimidate them or have petitions, as they did with Scott Atlas, or print daily attacks in the Stanford Daily against Neil Ferguson or myself or Scott Atlas. And then that would send a message to anybody who was slightly right of hard left wing that if you do something, you speak out, this is what's going to happen to you. And then like an adolescent, when people said, okay, we're going to just speak out, but we're not going to invite you inside the tent to burn it down. Then they just, you know, like an adolescent, they start crying and said, this is a violation of free speech. So
Victor, not cleanly related, but let's stay within the world of the academy. And there's another, another issue that's arisen in the last couple of weeks is this document, this letter that's been circulating amongst, right of left center, maybe even some left center, a rare professor, about restoring academic freedom. It's been reported on in various places. You're a signatory yourself to it, I believe, now quite over 1,000 college professors and emeritus.
1,500 or above, I'm not sure, but I think it's much. Okay. It's getting more and more people signed.
Yeah, this came about because of everything. You know, we've heard ad nauseum. Let me just read a quick little section here, and then get to the your view of what the true benefit of this document might be. It makes these charges. Universities and professional organizations are instead moving headlong into institutional, political, and ideological activism. Departments and other university units make public statements of political views, thus effectively branding as heretics and even bigots members who may question those causes. Increasingly, centers and quote-unquote accelerators are devoted to political and policy advocacy of the supporting ideologies and suppression of competing ideas. Professional organizations and journals announce all too often that certain kinds of research, no matter how methodologically valid, may not be published and have turned to advocacy. University bureaucracies demand that certain authors be included and others excluded from reading lists and classroom discussion. Victor, I don't know that anyone would disagree that that is a pretty clear assessment of what's going on in the academy today. This letter calls for the universities, associations, journals, etc., to adopt what they call the Chicago trifecta. And that has to do with the quote-unquote Chicago principles that came out in defense of free speech a few years ago, the Calvin Report, which is a requirement for institutional neutrality on political and social matters. And the third part of the Chicago trifecta is the Shills Report, which makes academic contribution the sole basis for hiring and promotion. Victor, I think this is good. This is good that it's being done. It's good that there are so many professors and scholars signing this. I don't know what effectively it will do in any one institution, and maybe that's not its point. But maybe the point is to show that, damn, I'm not alone. There are 1,500.
Yeah, I think that's the point. I think they're trying to tell university administrators, deans and provosts and presidents that you don't have to cater or you don't have to kowtow to these hard left extremists and worry over your job, that if you respect the principles of the First Amendment, then there's going to be people in the university community that will stand up and support you. And that's what it's aimed at. But again, it's a small number of people. And when you mentioned the Shills Report, I think that's a half century old. Edward Shills was a very distinguished public intellectual. I think he was a professor at one time at the University of Chicago, and a very famous guy. You know, he was a friend of Saul Bellow, et cetera, et cetera. He wrote this thing, or he was a primary architect of it a half century ago. So look what's happened. The subtext of all this, Jack, is that when Mario Salvio got out in the free speech area at UC Berkeley in the 60s, early 60s, his point was that you as a university don't have a right to have restrictive rules of expression because you're a public university that transcend what the Supreme Court or what legislation say is permissible. And there was a big argument, and they created a free speech. The compromise was that you could go out there and you could say the F word, or you could do almost anything. And remember, it was the left. It was the ACLU that said, we're going to defend free speech, even if it's Skokie, Illinois, and it's Nazis. We don't care. The more free speech, the better. And it was all the liberal law professors who said, you know, the Second Amendment was never designed to protect orthodoxy. Who would want a law that would protect orthodoxy? There's no need for it. The Second Amendment was designed solely to protect unpopular expression, minority expression. But that's all gone now. It's completely flipped. The left is the Soviet, Maoist, Orwellian mindset now. And the mindset is that we have a mission, and it's a quality of result. It's diversity, equity, inclusion, and radical climate change. And we'll throw in abortion to the day of birth, and we'll throw in transgenderism and these other issues. And they are so important that we have to have a monopoly on expression. And we're going to go after anybody who objects. And I don't mean just go after them and say, how dare you object? We're going to call you a racist. We're going to call you a Holocaust denier. We're going to call you a climate denialist. We're going to call you an insurrectionist. And that's what they do. And so there's people who say, you can't have a university like this. And that Shields document, just to go back to it, that was a pretty non-controversial idea that you wouldn't use criteria other than academic excellence and, well-known achievement. That was a matter of record in hiring and admissions and promotion, tenure, et cetera. Because what would be the alternative? The alternative would be tribalism. You would say, he's my first cousin. He's a member of my tribe. She's my daughter's in-law, whatever it is, nepotism or tribalism, and then that would override meritocracy. Remember what meritocracy was designed to do. It was a liberal concept that you wouldn't take into consideration gender, race, class, money, etc., aristocratic background. You would just say, we're all going to be thrown in the pot, and everybody is free to fail or succeed based on their own talents. And then what happened? The 60s championed that idea, and then they found out that it did not deliver the desirable results. This particular group, that particular cadre, did not achieve proportional representation. And by 1970s, they were confronted with a fundamental choice. If you don't have enough African Americans, just to take one example, that are getting into Harvard or Stanford or Yale, and that's what you want to achieve, because their test scores or their GPAs are not competitive as, say, other groups that are, quote unquote, non-white, maybe Punjabis or Asian Americans from Taiwan or South Korea or Japan, then we're going to make sure that they have an equality of opportunity. We're going to go into the inner city. We're going to have academies. We're going to offer Latin. We're going to create all of these instructional help at the early stage, kindergarten, K through three. We're not going to have therapeutic courses like Black Studies that, quote unquote, will give you self-esteem. We're going to acquire it naturally by your excellence and achievements, what Tom Sloan spent his whole life trying to articulate and to persuade people. And then they said, no, we're not going to do that. Well, that's a lot of work. It's just, who would ever want to go into South Central Los Angeles and set up a private academy where kids wore uniforms and they took Latin? And then,
what was that movie, Victor? I'm terrible with this.
Stand and Deliver, I think, wasn't
it? Yeah. Oh, well, Stand and Deliver.
Edward Almost, right.
The math teacher. Yeah, it's for real. It can be done.
Well, I tried to do it for 20 years at Cal State. I was farming. I was 28 years, 29 years old, and I went up there, and it was the closest university. And I said, look, I had a PhD from Stanford. I got it when I was 25, 26. I've been farming, but I think I could offer a program. And they said, we don't offer Greek. We only have one Latin class. What are you talking about? And then I kept at it, and I was hired part-time, and then I hired a brilliant colleague, Bruce Thornton, and then next thing I knew, we hired, and we had at one point five professors, and the whole point was that demographic who went to Cal State Fresno was largely at that time increasingly poor whites from the Oklahoma diaspora, from the southern San Joaquin Valley especially. It was Mexican Americans, many of them what we would call not illegal, that's the improper word now, but undocumented. So African American, but a lot of Southeast Asian first and second generation Hmong. And we went, it was a very diverse group. And we said to them, we're going to teach you Latin. We're going to teach you Greek. We're going to give you a strong minor or an individual major in ancient history. We're going to offer composition in Latin or Greek by special tutorials. We're going to read literature, mythology in translation. We're going to have humanities from Homer all the way through the Renaissance, and then from the Renaissance to the modern period. We're going to do all this. And if you want to go on, we don't suggest you do, but if you want to go on and be a professor, or you think you want to go to law school, or you want to go to business school or medical school, we're going to design a master's program in the history department for a year or two that will make up any remedial work necessary that you lacked in K through 12, even though we've had you 4 years. But we maybe with an extra year or two, your GRE, SAT, LSAT, MCAT, whatever the test, and we're going to help you. We're going to, and we made, I mean, we had, I think it was 45 people over that 20-year period went to the Ivy League. Not that that's a rubric of success necessarily, but we had people that were, gosh, they went into business. They went to law school. They were very successful. And, you know, we had some support for the administration originally. We had a wonderful dean, Luis Costa, who's now deceased. Joe Satin, a now deceased dean, helped us. We had a president, Judith Kuipers, that was a big supporter. But finally, there was there grew a lot of resistance. And the resistance did not come from, of course, white supremacists. It came from the ethnic lobby of faculty and students who felt that these students were superior they were educated in a superior fashion, and therefore they were not beholden to the therapeutic community, because they had now, after 4 years, 5 years, developed such confidence in their communications, their written English prose, their knowledge of history, knowledge of languages. Many of them took 3 or 4 languages, that they didn't need anybody to tell them that they were victims. And that was a threatening idea. And it was also 24/7, because if you're going to do that project, and we should have done it nationwide, and I wasn't the original, I just emulated what I saw with other groups. It's a 24/7. Because you have students whose parents will come into you and say, you know, my son thinks he's too good now. He thinks he wants to go to the Ivy League. Or my daughter's got to be a waitress for 40 hours a week. And how's she going to study? How many hours does it take to learn Latin? You say 2,000 hours a year, perhaps. Well, those are 2,000 years he could be working on the farm. So you have to tell the parents. If somebody comes to you and says, Professor Hansen, I'm moving and I don't have a truck, you say, take my pickup. Here's the keys. Or if somebody said, I got in trouble with something and I'm on probation, you go to my office 8 to 9 when I'm not there every morning. You sit there and I will monitor you where you are. That's the kind of stuff you do. Or somebody comes in and says, I don't have enough money for shoes. And okay, here's a check. That's what teachers do. Right. But it gets exhausting, and especially when you're attacked for doing it. And so it makes you kind of jaded. And after 20 years, I was exhausted. But that was something that worked. And there's still that program is still there under different auspices, but it's still there. And if we did things, and again, I was emulative, not creative, but there it's everywhere. And we know what works. We know what works. If you have wealthy white coastal elites and they say, I want to make sure that if Stanford University has African Americans demographically proportional, that rubric will not only have superior test scores and GPAs, but it'll be superior to people in the general Stanford community. And you can do that if you're willing to invest your time and labor and to take criticism. But when you don't do that and you promote on the basis of race or gender or tribal or ethnic affiliation, and you haven't had a meritocratic component to that, then you're going to be in an endless cycle of excuses and rationalizations and contextualization. Well, this person didn't do as well because this, that, and that, and therefore we're going to overlook the results because of this and that and those and these. And that's where we are.
Victor, there's a very worthwhile story we'll talk about after the break about what's happened in San Francisco on the election, the folks that run the election system there, and all about, as you just brought up, meritocracy and race-based criteria. But before we do that, which and then we'll have to have a little commercial, I am interested, I can't help but ask, when you first had this idea to create this program, what were the initial, did you have a eureka moment? And did when you first contacted someone at the college, was there initial interest, or was there
no,
like, who the hell are
none,
you? What are you crazy?
None, no. I came back with a PhD from Stanford in 1980. I'd finished my thesis, but I had a Whiting Fellowship, so I didn't file for the degree because I spent a year preparing it for publication and working, coming home on weekends and farming. And then I came home. There were no jobs for a white male in 1980, believe me. It was in a recessionary climate anyway. And I came home and farmed full time with my siblings. And I went up immediately. I looked at the university and I thought, wow, there's a CSU, I've known it, Cal State Fresno. It's big, 12 at that time. I think it's over 20, it was 12. There's a community college in Reedley. There's a community college in Vallejo. And I went to all of them. And it was no, 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 no. And usually it was who in the world would want to take Latin or Greek? And then I went to Cal State and there was a professor who taught German in one class of Latin. And he said, no, I don't want anybody else here. And then I went to the chairman. He said, no. And in their defense, I didn't wear a tie and suit. I was farming. So I drove up in a pickup truck and walked in with, you know, t-shirt and work boots. But they thought I was insane. And I went 1980, 1981, 1982, 1983. And finally, the person who taught one Latin class got ill. And I jumped at it. They called me and said, hey, they didn't give me much warning. This person is ill, and would you like to do it? And I came up there for a class, and then I started doing these things, and it started to expand. And then I gave a lecture, a public lecture, about classics. And one of the senior members of the McClatchy, very liberal family, heard it and said, this is wonderful. What would it take? I said, I'd have to be full time. And so she gave a donation. I think it was $22,000. And that paid my salary for 1 year with the proviso that if it worked, and I had to teach five classes, if it worked, then the university had to give me a chance. And so I taught five classes. And I thought I was in heaven making $22,000 with benefits. And the next thing I knew, they said, okay, we'll give you a lectureship for another year. I know job security, and then, but we're going to see if it works. So I did it third year, actually. And then they said, okay, we're going to have a tenure track appointment, but we're going to search nationwide. And they did. They had 160 applicants for the job that I created. And I was a white male applying for my own job on a permanent basis. And I can remember, I won't mention names, the chairman said to me, you know, there's some really good candidates that are people of color and with a different, and would you be too offended after you created this position that we hired one of them instead of you? I said, if they're better qualified, go ahead. But they had no teaching, they're right out of graduate school. And so that was kind of stressful. And then I got it. And then I decided, you know, I need more and more help because the thing just took off. And then I started hiring people and, you know, it was very hard to hire in those days because you had what we called an affirmative action officer. In classics did not have a lot of people of color. And they said, you're not going to hire a white male. We had a white male in the English department part-time. It was brilliant, Bruce Thornton. And I could not hire him for 5 years it took. But there was a lot of institutional opposition. And from my department, there was opposition. And then I decided that they wanted what they call full-time equivalent funding. And that means for each student, you get credit in budgetary terms. So I began to offer huge classes in Greek history, Roman history, mythology, things like that. And when I did that, I'd get 60, 70, 80 people. You, if you teach five classes, you're supposed to have 125. If you teach four, 100. And I could get 70 in one class,
right,
which meant, you know, 70 term papers, 70 midterm, 70 finals. You had to correct, no teaching support. And then I could offer, I don't know, Petronius or Livy or Tacitus with 9 in advanced Latin, and maybe Aeschylus. Well, I did teach the Prometheus Bound once, but I could teach Euripides or Aristophanes or Herodotus with, you know, 7 or 8. And I'd have, you know, 3 sections of Latin with 30, but I could get my 125 per faculty. And once I did that, they said, you know, and finally we were getting like 150 students per faculty position. And that meant there would be no longer any opposition, and you could offer courses that were necessary for classics. Right. And believe me, I can tell you without any hubris that if you look at the Princeton classics department that just said that Greek, right, and Latin were not necessary to major, and what a classics major, an individual major at Cal State Fresno, it was much more rigorous than what is offered now at Princeton.
You are, and I know you are, a persistent man, Victor Davis Hanson. So anyway, we're going to talk next about San Francisco, and we'll do that right after these important messages.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe, now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Back with the Victor Davis Hanson Show. Our happy home on the internet is John Solomon's justthenews.com. I'd like to recommend to our listeners to visit victorhanson.com, and you'll love what you see. You'll see plenty of links to things Victor writes, but you're going to try and click on some of these articles, and you're not going to be able to access them. Why? Because they're ultra articles. They're pieces Victor writes exclusively for victorhanson.com. You are depriving yourself if you do not subscribe, and I wish you would. It's tested out, $5. It's all you need to stick your toe in the water and see this treasure trove of great material Victor writes every week, in and out. There's a lot of content, and you'll get that for the year, which is discounted for $50. So victorhanson.com. You'll also find links to his books. You've got Christmas coming up. If you know someone who's a fan of Victor, go click on the book links, and you'll find plenty of good stuff that will make very welcome Christmas gifts. As for myself, Jack Fowler, I write for the Center for Civil Society at American Philanthropic, a free weekly email newsletter called Civil Thoughts that offers a dozen and then some recommended readings, that things I've come across in the previous week. It's a free email newsletter. That we're not building a list. We're not selling your names. We're not trying to sell you anything. Links to the articles and some excerpts. Lots of folks like it. So check it out. Go to civilthoughts.com and you can sign up for that. And I do want to recommend visit also, please, AmericanPhilanthropic.com. You'll see a little link for events. Click on that. Find the event free on December 6th. I will be hosting a webinar with Victor and Tony Woodleaf. Tony's the author of I, Citizen. Victor is author of The Dying Citizen, and we're going to be having a one-hour webinar on the fragility of citizenship. Again, it's a free webinar, so I hope you'll consider attending that. Victor, speaking earlier about meritocracy, race-based criteria, et cetera, there's kind of a startling and, to me, blatantly racist story that's out of San Francisco. And I know you and Sammy did a great episode a couple of weeks ago about things all about San Francisco. But this came out the other day, headline of a story, San Francisco elections official released from contract because he is white male. His name is John Arntz. The commission that if he has overseen San Francisco's elections for the last 20 years, he operates in, you know, 5-year cycles. He's a contractor, and he has received sterling acclaim from the commission that oversees this. But that same commission, in a 4-2 vote, in a closed session in late November, voted to decline to renew a 5-year contract for Arntz, John Arntz, so that the city could quote, take action, end quote, on its, quote, racial equity plan. He was commended, by the way, for the head of the commission for his impeccable service over the years. This is not... This is not the America that Martin Luther King was talking about, Victor, was it?
No, and I think they'll be subject to litigation because they're not even subtle about it. Usually when people do this, they use race as the only criteria for hiring. They talk about intangibles. Well, maybe, say, an admission, the test scores are not there, or the GPA is not there, but there's community service that can't be calibrated, or there's experience for a candidate, or there's fee days among particular marginal. But they didn't even try this. They just said, you know, a senior position is quite a plum, and this guy is a white male, and he's just occupying a space that takes it away from a person of color. And I don't know when we're going to get to the point where we call it racism. And I mean that sincerely, because the institutionalized critical race theory, ethnic studies of the university, has brainwashed America into thinking that if you're a person of color, you can't be racist, when anybody knows that all humans can be racist. And there is no rainbow coalition. There's no the diversity monolithic. You can see that in elections increasingly. But this idea that you just simply discriminate against somebody on the color of her skin is racist. And I guess it's predicated on there are so many liberal judges that came in during the Clinton and Obama years that you're bound to get a federal judge that will not hear your case. And there's not enough conservatives. I don't know why they deliberately violate the Civil Rights Act and they feel they can get away with it. And it tells you that the deterrence is on the left. They are more afraid of left-wing mobs, protesters, activists, political officials than they are the law, because they don't think the law is going to be enforced that prohibits that discrimination. And it won't change until not just once or twice, but systematically people sue and they win. And then it will change because it will cost them too much. But think about, there was no criticism that he was partisan. I think even the mayor said that he was completely politically independent. London Breed said that.
Right. The mayor woman actually opposed the commission.
So the point was, it's kind of resonant of Alexis de Tocqueville's stunning admissions and one of the most famous passages in Democracy in America. And he said, America's engaged on this constitutional democratic experiment, and we worship well, and I think it will work because of free-holding agrarianism that's going to help it. There's not going to be a peasant class, but it has to be very careful because most people would rather be equal and collectively poor than to be collectively better off, but have some people more better off. And I think they're saying we would rather... This commission is saying we would rather be proportionally representative, even if we run a risk of having somebody biased or prejudicial holding elections because we have somebody that we know didn't do that, but he's white. And it's the same principle. And I don't know at what point America just collectively says, we're not going to do that anymore. You look at polls and people say, do you believe in using race as the primary criteria of race? It doesn't poll more than 40%. So the public is against it, but the elites are for it. And it's not just the Al Sharptons of the world or the Obamas of the world that have been direct beneficiaries of it. It's wealthy, the same old crowd. It's wealthy, mostly white, bi-coastal elites. And they are adamant in defending this system, which they never abide by. If they have a white male son who went to prep school and he wants to go to MIT or Harvard or Yale or Stanford or Berkeley, by God, they're going to find a way to get him in. And that means either a donation or calling up a friendly dean or talking to somebody they know. But for everybody else, for Joe Smith, that, you know,
right.
I don't know, he works as a telephone installer in Dayton, Ohio, who's a white male, working class kid with a perfect GPA and top test. He's not going to get in.
Mm-hmm. No way. No way. Unless he identifies as a woman, maybe maybe then he might. Hey, Victor, another troubling story, and this is really troubling to me. I would assume it might be also for our listeners, is a the results of a survey that came out the other day by Resume Builder. So resumebuilder.com did polled 1,131 hiring managers and recruiters across a broad series of industries, from agriculture to, you know, high tech. And the questions are about perceptions on Jews. And would you hire a Jew? Would you try to prevent a Jew from being hired, etc.? This is, I think it was precipitated in part by some of the news that's been out recently. Kanye West, who we talked about on our most recent podcast, Kyrie Irving with the Nets, Dave Chappelle had some comments related to Kanye West. So whatever precipitated this poll, the findings are really disturbing. Here are some of them. 26% of hiring managers say they are less likely to move forward with Jewish applicants. The top reason for the negative bias is a belief that Jews have too much power and control. 26% make assumptions about whether a candidate is Jewish based on their appearance. 23% say they want fewer Jews in their industry. 17% say their corporate leadership has told them not to hire Jews. And a third say anti-Semitism is common in the workplace. 29% say anti-Semitism is acceptable in their company. Victor, this is really, I mean, to me, alarming, even surprising. Maybe I shouldn't be surprised. Maybe I thought all the other cultural yammerings about Jews and hostility to Jews, say from AOC and the whatever they're called, I forget the group of those congresswomen and such.
The squad.
Excuse me. Maybe I thought it was just reflective of cranks, but this is disturbing. Anyway.
Well, I think what we have to realize behind this is that there's always anti-Semitism. And say 80 years ago, 70 years ago, the left was the protector of Jews in the workplace, in the public arena. And they were always going after, I think justifiably so, small contingents of right wingers, you know, the Klan, and really hard right, fascist, American Nazi, all those groups. And that's changed. And so it has been mainstream. So when you talk about anti-Semitism, it's coming from the left, and it's coming from a variety of different ways. It's coming from the Kanye West African-American complaint that so that they don't control, they talk about NBA players as being slaves working for Mr. Silver, who's the NBA commissioner. They talk about LeBron James is not in control of his destiny. Kanye West is talking about all the Hollywood producers and financiers and directors who are Jewish. And then you add in the squad who comes at it from a different, you know, it's about the Benjamin's baby, Ilhan Omar, or, you know, AOC doesn't even know where Israel is on the map, apparently. And you had Tlaib, and she's always blessed. So you have the anti-Israel and that popular narrative that the Palestinians are like people of color in the United States, and they're being oppressed by white overlords, which are the Jews of Israel, that line. And then there are people who look at primary people in the news, a Jeffrey Epstein, a Harvey Weinstein, a Sam Bankman. And then if you can read literature, well, they'll very subtly suggest that this is not because they're left wingers or not because they come out of a bicoastal bankrupt moral culture, but because they're Jews. And so all of those feed into this narrative, and it's becoming acceptable because the left doesn't say anything against it. And when you add in the knockout game and you see these traditional attacks on very Orthodox Jews,
right?
People, no one seems to call that a hate crime.
Right.
Or when you look at what's going on, you know, I mean, I'll be frank. If you look at the last year that we had statistics, I think it was right before COVID, 2019. I think it's increased since. My own popular impression is that the African American community is 12% of the population, but it accounts for 25%. Of the hate crimes. And that's largely not the African American community. That's the African American community of males between the ages of 14 and 40 that have a criminal record. And they are inordinately and asymmetrically attacking Asians and Jews. And there's not a lot of popular outrage about it. You see, the Asian community has even had young spokespeople say, this isn't, we're not going to talk about who's doing this, and the same thing with the Jewish community. But I'm getting at there's all these currents, and they join together in a kind of a tidal wave of acceptability. So if you're a popular person and you denigrate Jewishness, you're probably going to get away with it. And Kanye West doubled down. And I think there was a demonstration for the other day of the Black Hebrew movement in Brooklyn, where all of these people said, you know, we're tired of attacking black athletes who have criticized Jews. We're the only Jews. They're not Jews. We're the real Israelites. It's kind of a crazy idea, but it's acceptable now. And the left, let's face it, Jack, the left has become the source of anti-free speech, racialization, segregation, separation, tribalism, ethnic chauvinism. It is intolerance. It really is now. People should wake up to that.
Yeah. You know, one thing, Victor, last thought on this for me is I mentioned this piece once before in a podcast a few years ago. It was probably about 3 years ago. Chris Caldwell did a significant essay in the Claremont Review of Books about how human resources departments, how they kind of rule America and rule America culturally, because this is where you're not going to get hired, right? Or you will get hired, or you will come, look at someone the wrong way. And there's so much tumult, cultural tumult in America has generated from HR, right? HR runs the show. And it kind of makes sense that the recruiters and the hirers of the world are it's a lefty profession. HR is a lefty profession, and it kind of makes sense here that
put it this way, the impression, whether it's accurate or not, but it is accurate to say the impression, say, at most workplaces or universities, is that if you're a white male and you go to HR and say that you're an object of racial slurs or discrimination, or if you're Jewish and you go there and say that people are anti-Semitic in your workplace or your class or the professor, you're going to go nowhere. It doesn't. That's not the purpose of an HR. The purpose of an HR is to protect the university or the corporation or the institution from so-called Al Sharpton-like pressure groups that will call you racist or sexist or homophobic or transphobic. And so they understand that. And so that's what they're worried about. They are not worried about the principles of discrimination and non-discrimination. They just don't. It's not. It's a particular type that they feel can cost them money or social prestige, or they'll be able to virtue signal or performance art about. But that's what they are. They're highly weaponized. I can tell you that from, I won't mention names or institutions, but I've had colleagues that have gone to the HR and said, you know, that this person pushed me, or this person said, called me this name, and they didn't do anything. And I know that same HR would have fired the perpetrator had it been in a different context.
Well, Victor, we have time for one more topic, and it will be about forgiveness. And we'll get to that right after these important messages.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
We're back with the Victor Davis Hanson Show. Victor, I appreciate your on letting me my mind wander onto a topic or two every once in a while. And one of them is forgiveness. And we had talked a couple of weeks ago on a podcast. I mentioned this picture I had seen. It was the 50th anniversary of the Battle of Gettysburg. And you had these old veterans in gray and blue shaking hands with each other. And to me, yeah, obviously this was a sign of, we 50 years ago here, we tried to kill each other, but we have to get beyond that, and we have to have forgiveness and move ahead, because without that, in 2022 on the left, where presentism is so damn important, the concept of forgiveness, whether it's a Christian based or whether it's based in the classics, this is the goal, is to get your thoughts on that. Is an enemy. Forgiveness is an enemy of leftist ideology. That may be pretty basic. People listening might say, duh, we know that. But I don't know. It seems to me so central to leftism to have hostility towards forgiving our sins of our neighbors and whatever sins of our past. Victor, I am interested in your view on forgiveness and from the classics and however else you want to discuss it. what was Socrates and Plato and others, or maybe through Greek tragedy theater, what were the concepts of forgiveness in ancient times? And anything else you'd like to say about this?
Well, I'm a philologist, so when we want to know what present vocabulary means and where it derives from, we go back to Latin and Greek in the West. And so there's a Latin word, remissio, remitto, to remit, to give up or to let go of or to send off. And it comes from the concept in Greek of apohiemi or aphiemi in the compounded form, which means to release from, send out. And what I'm getting at is that, that if you want to offer clemency, that's a Latin word, clementia, or you want to, you know, you're going to forgive somebody. It's not a moral, it doesn't come morally from your soul or from even your intellect. It's more of a practical matter. So clementia caesaris is the idea that Caesar is going to forgive all of his enemies, and that's going to unify the Roman Republic around him, and that he's going to take a chance that his enemies won't interpret that magnanimity, which is it's in Aristotle's ethics, especially the great souledness, that they're not going to take advantage and interpret magnanimity as weakness to be exploited rather than magnanimity to be reciprocated. So it's a practical idea, and that's what it is in Greek originally. Then when you get the fusion of classical culture with Christianity and you look at the New Testament, and you look at the early church fathers, then you start to see that clementia starts to change and it becomes a moral, not a practical idea, that it's going to reflect the way the world must work on the basis of Sermon on the Mount principles. And in Greek, they have a word that is an old word, but it starts to get new currency, charizomai. We get charity from it, charis. And it means that there is a forgiveness of sin. It's the New Testament doctrine that no matter what you've done, you have an avenue to regain your soul and regain your morality, and we will formally forgive you in that process for the sins. And that's a very different idea than the early Greek notion, and maybe even the early Greek notion that predominated all the way down to the advent of Christianity, that you help your friends and you punish your enemies. And if you don't punish your enemies, then they take advantage of you and you hurt your friends. And if you don't help your friends only, then you create a non-deterrent or a weak personality. So I think you could argue that the vocabulary starts to reflect the advent of Christianity in a very new idea, that it's not just practical in some cases to forgive enemies or to forgive people, but it's also a pathway into salvation, and it's in accordance with the principles of Jesus Christ as articulated. And I just mentioned the sermon of turn the other cheek or do unto others as others would, blessed are the meek, that kind of idea.
Well, thank you, Victor. I appreciate that. And it's nice to every once in a while we talk about something that's not necessarily in the headlines, although lack of forgiveness is always in the headlines when you're reading about Black Lives Matter and other such organizations.
No, there's no such thing as there's no such thing as forgiveness in modern America in left-wing political terms, that you're always an enemy or always guilty or always sinful. I saw Michelle Obama the other day said that she couldn't wear cornrows or braids in her hair because America was not ready for that yet on November. And think of the implications of that even though I'm first lady, and even though I'm probably the most successful memoirist of any author alive, I've made more money. And even though we have four beautiful homes, even though we're worth over $100 million, this racist country would not let me express myself with braids in my hair. Now, right. Bo Derek did it, right? She did it, and she seemed to thrive very well.
She was a Republican, too.
Exactly. So if she can do it, I think an African-American, and we see women through all through the workplace, it's the top levels and then Hollywood celebrities that have all sorts of hairstyles and nobody cares. And if we don't care that Joe Biden is shaking somebody's hand who doesn't exist, or he believes that his late son died in Iraq, or the Iraq war was the, I don't know what it was. It was the Ukraine war at one point, and at one point it was the Afghanistan war. If we're tolerant of that, we're tolerant of fashion and grooming unorthodoxies.
Well, you can have four houses and millions of dollars and be the former first lady, but you still on the left have to be a victim.
You have to be a victim, because if you're not a victim, then the question goes back to who are you? Mm-hmm. If you're not, if you're Jussie Smollett and you're not a victim, then maybe you're not a very good actor that is going to lose a job in a series that's coming to an end. And your career is going to be, I don't know, people are not impressed with your acting skills, apparently. So then you have to become a famous victim, even if that requires suspending the laws of chemistry. So somebody throws bleach at you that doesn't freeze at, you know, 20 degrees or 18 degrees, but you can accomplish that. And so, again, there's a principle to all of these discussions we're having is once you get away from reality and truth and meritocracy, and you get into all of these efforts at repertory language, repertory admissions, repertory hiring, original sins that go back, and we judge the past by the, when you get into all of that, then you get into a tangled web of lies, and you just have to keep lying and lying and lying and accusing and accusing, and you have less and less credibility. And that's going to be one of the great questions of the next decade, because I think what's happening, it doesn't have anything to do with Trump, but I do believe that a lot of people, not just the white majority, but also African Americans and Latinos and Asians, are saying, you know what, I don't see systematic racism. And I look at per capita income, because America's a plutocracy, and I look at what Asians are doing, or Arab Americans, or other groups, and many of them, Cubans, they have parity with the so-called white majority, or they have greater income. I think 17 ethnic groups have a higher per capita or family income than so-called white people, but they don't see it. And at this point, they're going to say, this is, I'm getting tired of this. Just don't do it anymore. If you have a problem and you feel that, you know, that you're a victim of some type of bias or prejudice, then overcome it and do it through accomplishment. And you can do that in the United States. And the thing the left hates the most is anybody who brings up Asians, because the Asian community systematically has higher incomes, better admission rates to so-called Tony universities than does the white majority. And even though they can point to egregious examples of collective prejudice in our past, whether it's the Japanese internment or the Yellow Peril laws, et cetera, et cetera. And yet they overcame. And so when you mention that, even young Asians will say, oh, we're not the good minority. Don't stigmatize us. But the point is that they're sort of the canary in the mine. And then when you add Punjabis from India, or you add Arab Americans, and you start to see all of these different groups that are not Western European, or not of Western European ancestry, or Southern European, whatever term we use for European ancestry, and they're very successful, then particular groups get very angry at that. And they said, don't do that. We're special, that group. And even though we know that Asian Americans, since in the last 20 years, predictably vote left wing. So it's not like the right is pointing to some right wing group. And I think Jesse Jackson once said, if you want to get ahead, if you're an ethnic group, you just take a picture of what an Asian person is doing all day long and emulate it. That was kind of a racist thing. And he got a lot of criticism. But then he got a lot of criticism in that earlier incarnation. Remember when he said, I hear steps behind me and I turn
around? I do indeed remember that. Yep.
I hope that it's not an African American young male.
Right. Right. So, yeah. Yeah. Well, Victor, you've been great today, as you are every day. I appreciate the wisdom you shared. And so do our listeners who go to Apple Podcasts or iTunes and rate the show. Thank you. No matter what platform you're listening on, Google Play, Stitcher, if you listen on Victor's website directly, justthenews.com. But at Apple, you can leave us no stars, or you can leave up to 5 stars. And it's everybody, practically everybody leaves a 5-star rating. It's 4.999. The ratings are, it's one of the most highly rated podcasts out there. And that's because of Victor's relentless wisdom. Some people leave comments, and here's one. We read them all. And here's one we will actually read now. It's from Uncle Bush Baby. It's titled Beaming Light in Darkness. You will never find another man as wise, insightful, and enlightening as VDH. Funny and entertaining, too. He is the father, grandfather everybody needs. I am 30 now, and I've been listening to VDH since the days with Troy, 2018, 2019. He doesn't mean the city of Troy. He means Troy Senek, when Victor had a podcast with Troy on Ricochet. Sir, you have opened my eyes and shielded me from the modern societal decay. I work in corporate, but I live on a farm growing sugarcane and raising cattle. I also recently started a family. Your experiences and insight they've helped me navigate this life. Sincere love and respect from a South African youth living in thick of what now sounds like California today. Uncle Bush Baby. So thank you for your kind words, and all else who write and leave comments here and on Victor's website. We read them all. Thanks very much again for listening. Thank you, Victor, for the wisdom you shared. And we'll be back soon with another episode of the Victor Davis Hanson Show. Have a good day.
Thank you, Jack. And thank everybody for listening again.